football on off the ball.
He played down at Millwall a couple of times in the Den. That was at a time when Danny Shiddu was the captain of Millwall, and he used to stand at the front of the tunnel with no top on and bark like a dog. Honestly, we can laugh now because it is a bit funny, but it's the most intimidating thing I've ever seen.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
The Sunday Paper Review on Off the Ball.
Welcome to the Paper Review on Off the Ball. I'm Dion Fanning, sitting in today, and I'm joined by Linda Marr, Assistant Editor of the Irish Daily Mail, and Declan Lynch of the Sunday Independent. And what did you also want me to add? Author of Tony 10, now Tony available 10. On audiobook.
That's right.
Okay, everything covered, all the mentions covered. We'll look at the headlines first today. Sunday Mirror, oh man, Doku, Haaland and Marmoush late show keep City just 2 points behind. Sun Sport, MC Hammer, Pep closes gap, crosses arms and roars, come on you Irons. We'll be talking maybe about Alex Ferguson and what he would have done in these situations, and you know, it was a lot more robust than just come on you Irons. Sunday Times is Doku delivers again. Mail on Sunday is gunning for you. City keep pressure on Arsenal ahead of Hammers clash. And the Sunday Independent has Rebels in final push. And then below that, Slot explains call as fans boos hit home. We might come back to that in a minute, Declan. But I want to talk to you first, folks, about the title race, the Premier League title race. And a few pieces today. Obviously, City's win yesterday makes it still a tense affair, and a number of the pieces today, Tommy Conlon in the Sunday Independent, Martin Samuel online in the Sunday Times, not in the Irish edition, talking about the celebration police and whether Arsenal, after their victory in the semi-final of the Champions League on Tuesday night, should be celebrating, or Wednesday night.
Yeah. Well, Tommy Conlon recalls the time of the Alex Ferguson when Manchester United played West Ham. It was perhaps the last game of the season in 1992, and somehow West Ham, I think, were already doomed. They managed to beat United, and Fergie described it as almost obscene. he put in the almost, but you know he actually meant obscene, right? So West Ham have this peculiar habit, after having a completely terrible season, to sort of destroy some decent team's life, right at the end. But that was in the time of Upton Park, and I've sensed that they were a proper football club, and you could actually generate a bit of atmosphere there and a bit of kind of aggression and all that. Hard to see it happening in the old London Stadium. I still think Arsenal are a little bit fragile, you know. Everybody now thinks it's kind of done, I think, but I don't know, even like away to Palace in the last game, I always think that those games are on paper. You never look at people are always looking at them on paper, and they never really turn out like that, you know. So, it's automatically assumed that they will beat Palace, and it's that everyone has just put in 3 points for that, which means it probably won't be like that, you know. I don't know. No, I think the celebration police should be absolutely out in large numbers.
Do you? Well, it's funny, just on the Fergie thing, I suppose the counterpoint to the London Stadium is the fact that in those days, those situations, you did have Alex Ferguson. Whatever about the celebration police, you had the Alex Ferguson secret police out in the force, making sure that everything was enforced, you know, that every... Because it's 30 years... Amazingly, it's 30 years this year since the I Would Love It Kevin Keegan, which has to be described as a rant, which again was triggered by another fantastic bit of Fergie power and control when he said that Leeds after they'd only lost 1-0 to Manchester United, Leeds were cheating their manager.
You see, Fergie had that great gift of infusing bitterness into everything, including his success. I mean, he was one of these people of whom it is said he was embittered by success. You'd often find that when he'd sort of won something, he was even angrier. Whereas, like, when they were going through a bad period, he became quite relaxed and
sympathetic,
yeah, sort of empathy, all these kind of things would flow from him, you know. So
I think that West Ham game against United, you know, will haunt me to my end of days. Right. You know, Ludwig McClosco, you know, still comes to me in my nightmares, and I still think there's a twist or two left in this. I think, you know, again, nobody expected Monday night, the result Everton got on Monday night. I don't think anybody expected that. So, you know, I still think there's plenty to go. But, I whatever about, the season's not over for Arsenal, but you've just won a semi-final. You know, you're going to a final that won't be in front, you know, that won't be in your home stadium. I mean, I think you're very entitled to celebrate with the fans who are there. There was a lot, I think, you know, the Bayern game during the week, their fans were incredible, at the end of that game. They've been beaten and, you know, they were there for probably 20, 25 minutes. I was in Gdansk and Poznan when the Irish fans were there till the bitter, bitter end. And, you know, I always think celebration police are not people who go to games, because you just don't understand that passion that, you know, it might not be a celebration, it might be a commiseration, but you're all in this together.
And what do you think, Linda, like, you know, well, the number of the people, the celebration police seem to be pundits as well, because Wayne Rooney, Tommy Conlon quotes Wayne Rooney, "I think the celebrations are a little bit too much," he said on Amazon Prime, "celebrate when you win." Now, that's the ultra professional point of view. You've won nothing yet, get down the tunnel celebrate when you've won. But as you say, they've got to a Champions League final for the first time in 20 years.
That's coming from somebody who won a lot.
Yeah.
You know, you're not in the same position that these players are in, that the fans are in, you know, where that kind of success hasn't come as often as it did for Rooney. And, you know, I'm fairly sure that Wayne's first couple of finals and league titles were celebrated very, very well on and off the pitch, I'd say, with Wayne.
Yeah, the more I think of it, I wonder, is there ever a justification or a time for celebration in
life,
like in life, particularly in football, almost like, you know, say when Liverpool beat Barcelona that time 4-0, clearly there was a moment of great ecstasy for about 5 seconds, and then you think, but what about the next, you know, what happens now if they don't win this thing, you know? So
But it's really, I don't know about that, because does winning really, like, Liverpool is a good example of how you felt mattered a lot more than winning. Mm. And Klopp was the master at creating an atmosphere and making people feel part of something, whether the team were winning or losing. It wasn't about the ultimate, you know, and he always said this, and there's a clip going around again about, I think it was after the Europa League final, I saw a clip recently on Instagram of when they'd lost, and he'd lost how many finals in a row at that point. And he said, "I'm going to lose more finals, but I'll keep getting here." And Klopp, and I know you want to talk about Liverpool, Declan, but like Klopp actually embodies that thing that ultimately there is something more important at play in sport than winning and losing. Because he won one league title, one Champions League, and yet it doesn't matter because how he made Liverpool fans feel far outweighs the ledger. And Arsenal should celebrate now because they've reached a Champions League final, and they haven't done that in 20 years.
I think that's coming from the manager as well. Like, in, you know, I think he's been far more exercised on the touchline in recent weeks than he was up to then. You know, and I think he sees himself as leading this charge into, you know, that kind of, if it's coming from him down, that if he looks confident and, you know, he looks like he's up for this, basically, then so will the players. So I think there's a lot of that coming into it as well with Arteta.
There are no celebration police out at Anfield at the moment.
There's no need.
There's no need. The police have been stood down.
We've lost touch with that. It's like, you know, that Klopp thing you were talking about, you know. I often feel when I look at, say, Americans' attitude to sport, you know, like when you look at CNN, right? And you think, these people do not understand anything about it. They don't get it. They think it's all happy and funny and all that, you know? And And it's not. It's about an awful lot of things, right? It's not even about enjoying yourself necessarily. You know what I mean? They seem to always think it's about that. But when you get to the level that Liverpool are at now, it's about there's a whole dystopia that we've entered. And it's the last time I was here, two times I was here, something terrible had happened to Liverpool, and I was explaining how it was no longer sustainable for Slot to be there. It simply wasn't. I mean, for all sorts of reasons. And he's still there. And it's one of these very interesting examples of the only people who think he should still be there are the people who are the only people who have the power to get rid of him. So that is a problem, you know, that the... everybody else, as far as I know, in the world of Liverpool has made up their minds about this months ago. I mean, back in November, really. I mean, this is the problem with it now is that it's got to the end of the season and they've wasted all that time.
But do you not think there's an intellectual argument that says that Slot should stay, like needs to stay, deserves the opportunity to get a, you know, he's won the league. Like there is a appalling vista for Liverpool where they fall into the trap of Manchester United and just start churning through managers. They're, you know, going back to the summer and the tragic death of Diogo Jota and onwards then, there are a number of factors that you can actually put down and say, these are reasons for Liverpool's season not going the way they would have anticipated or they would have hoped. And if you actually... now say, well, we're done. If we, you know, since November, some people have been saying get rid of him. If you had done that, there's no guarantee with any manager you get in that it's going to get any better.
There's no guarantee with anything though. So like they would, I mean, Manchester United, oddly enough, eventually sacked the right manager and brought in somebody else who at least got a few results.
Who's that?
Michael Carrick.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah. But he's he'll be gone. He'll be gone.
Yeah. Okay. But it did actually demonstrate that they played better with a different manager, right? Mm. So otherwise you just never get rid of any manager, right? So I mean, there is a point, and if Liverpool fans very generally do take a very obviously they're quite emotionally involved, but all of those reasons you say, of course, on paper, in the same way as, you know, on paper, Arsenal are going to win the league on paper, right? But it's not. There's something else going on there. For example, most of the players seem to want to leave. Things like that. You know, the best player they've ever had, practically, Mo Salah, was coming out and telling the media that this was an unsustainable situation months ago. I don't think that happened just because he was left out for two games. People say, yes, it would because he's got a huge ego. I still don't think if other things had been right at the club, he would have done that, right? That was such a major thing to happen that it clearly indicated that other people felt the same and of course, other very good players felt the same. And on a basic level, everybody can feel this sense that the players are not actually... performing. They're not doing it for him, right? Players would do anything for Klopp. I mean, that was the point. You had that sense of that you mentioned there, that sense of everybody involved in the same kind of project, right? There is no sense of that now.
But is there, Linda, Manchester United being a good example of this, like, you know, should people, when somebody like Ferguson or Klopp leaves, just resign themselves to the fact that things aren't going to ever be like this again and just, you know, write off 10, 15 years.
I'd like to say no, but, you know, events prove otherwise. I think it's incredibly difficult to come in after a manager like that. You know, I think Moyes didn't get the kind of bounce back off it that Slot did in his first season. And, you know, I think the general consensus was that was what was left there wasn't amazing. And so there's definitely, but the chopping and changing managers becomes a huge, huge problem. Yet at the same time, there's none of the Man United managers that were sacked that I can sit and say they didn't deserve to be sacked at that time. Like it had with almost every one of them, I think it had got bad enough that you thought there is no other way around this. I worry the Carrick situation is just another Solskjaer situation. That he comes in, there's a good run of results, and, you know, I mean, you look at the form table and it's a great run of results. Does he have what it needs, what's needed to take it on to the next level? I don't think he does. I don't think the players are there. If he does stay, are they going to give him the investment that is needed? And, you know, at the same time, money has been spent. A lot of money has been spent. It just hasn't been spent well. So I would feel for Liverpool fans in that you don't want to go down that road. It's a bad road to go down. And once you start down, it's very hard to turn back. But also, it has it become untenable?
Thankfully, we have the perfect candidate. My life has now become largely a quest for Andoni Iriola.
You've came into it today. You're like a kind of, you know, politician spin doctor who is telling it, except you're doing your own spin doctor. You're going to deliver one message here today.
And that's it. The one message. I'll just keep saying this throughout the programme. Iriola at Bournemouth, right?
Right.
He's a great manager. He is certainly the... Bournemouth could get into the Champions League instead of Liverpool, for God's sake.
But he's managing Bournemouth. This is the thing. David Moyes was a great manager at Everton. There is a fundamental shift.
Somebody has to manage Bournemouth before they manage. You know what I mean?
Klopp, Ferguson, Klopp managed Dortmund. Klopp was in Champions League finals. Mm. There was some exposure to what he's like. Under scrutiny. My essential point in this is just give up for a while. Just stop chasing the dream, or else get Jurgen Klopp back. That's how I think.
But life would have no meaning then. which is a point. It's all about Iriola now for me. It's all about Iriola. My God.
You're just taking notes there, but all you're just writing down is Iriola.
Anytime I see Bournemouth, which is quite a lot. They're brilliant.
They are very good.
Fantastic. And they're all with different players.
But if Bournemouth
loses his best players.
My point is that if Bournemouth lose three matches in a row, nobody notices.
I know that.
And that is the thing. And like Moyes is a great example. I was at Moyes' first press conference as Manchester United manager. And immediately it was like, oh God. He started talking about, you know, the call he got from Alex Ferguson. He was wearing jeans at the time, and he didn't want to go to Alex Ferguson's house wearing jeans, so he went home and got changed. And you suddenly this sense of a beta male, rather, replacing an alpha male became very, very obvious.
Andoni isn't like that. He's very much alpha. Some people are still calling him Ariola. For me, it's just Andoni. Here's the first paragraph of the report of Bournemouth's excellent victory against Fulham yesterday, right? Manager Andoni Iriola believes soul was the key to Bournemouth's win over Fulham. That's the man you want. You want, like, you know, all these lads on their laptops, you know, saying, you know, if you barge your opponents over the goal line from a corner, you'll get a goal. There's no soul there. This man has soul. And, there isn't even an issue here. This is
You're
the
not
future.
In the Alonso camp, no?
I would be happy to see the great man there. To criticise him for not being able to manage Real Madrid now seems so absurd, you know, as to be. The only thing you would almost question is, like, why did he even do that job, you know? But otherwise, that doesn't matter at all. Though I would be very, very happy to see Xabi Alonso there. One ex-Alonso, yes, I would take that. However...
the message. Thank you. You can leave then. You just pick up your papers and your notes and walk out of the studio.
I've made my case.
I'll be quiet enough for the rest of the show.
I want to talk, and somebody else with soul, I want to talk to a little snippet about Kenny Cunningham on the back page of Sunday Independent with Conor McKeown, where with the headline, Kenny decided to never let the facts get in the way of his poor analysis. Now, Connor starts this by saying, two of the most overrated things TV sports pundits can be: proficient with stats and right. Now, you know, from that very promising start, he then goes on to kind of talk about where Kenny Cunningham got it wrong in his analysis, his criticism of Arsenal. But that essential point is the truth, isn't it, Linda? Like, the last thing you want from punditry is, like, somebody who is just right and right through statistics.
It is. And, you know, the best pundits will argue with each other, but, you know, all believing they're right. And I thought the Kenny Cunningham tonight, it stopped you in your tracks. Like, it was, you know, kind of one of those, you get to halftime the game, kind of having a little scroll, and next to all the phones, but you're like, what is going on here? Like, you could hear it in Shea Given and Jamie, we're just incredulous as to, you know, and because this wasn't just, you know, and people can look at stats and have different opinions. And I am with Kenny on one thing, that stats can, you know, it's a very American thing. And like exactly what Declan was saying, stats take the heart out of it all, you know, because that's, and that's what gets you to titles is, you know, that extra bit. But, you know, to say that Arsenal's defence is not great when, you know, there is a stat sitting on the screen that says, with the four semi-finalists, the number of goals conceded by them in second place were Bayern with 19, which became 20. In first were Arsenal. In 14 games, they conceded 6 goals. You know, and as Jamie Duff said, an extraordinary stat. And it is extraordinary. So for Kenny to then sit there and say,
that was not a defensive masterclass from Arsenal tonight, Kenny went on, inviting a question as to how many goals Arsenal might have conceded in their 1-0 win had they produced one.
Yeah. Well, I still think Kenny, he understands a fundamental thing of the difference between that facts are fact, but ultimately one is involved in a search for truth. A higher truth rather than mere... for example, even the great John Giles sometimes would get the name of the Borussia Dortmund fullback wrong.
Yeah.
This is a matter of such total irrelevance because he knew everything about what the Borussia fullback should be doing.
He knew his moral code.
Yeah, absolutely. His actual name was so irrelevant in this situation because other people would know the guy's name but know none of the other stuff. Right, so I think we always have to have a balance here between the facts and the truth, and to know that there is a difference. And I think Kenny is in,
and he is, as Linda, you say, like as you say, that sensation you have of stopping what you're doing to actually watch his punditry.
Mm.
That's kind of priceless, really.
It is. It not so much when it's because you're actually going, what is he saying here? You know, but there is still that ability. And, you know, I remember, you know, when Graeme Souness first started doing RTE, he was amazed by the amount of criticism that, you know, the halftime commentary would heap on players. And he took that back to England. And you could see the difference in him when he went back to Sky Sports, having done it. And that, it kind of brought in a new era over there. If there was always that thing of, you kind of don't want to criticise too much, particularly don't criticise English players. And he kind of brought that back, going, hang on a second here. And, you know, so you do want your pundits to be, you know, outspoken. You do want them to put their point across. And it will always depend on who they are as well. Kenny's always going to pick up defensive, you know, things, whereas, you know, Ian Wright's going to talk about the strikers and what they've done. Keane is going to look at your midfielders and what was he doing in the mid. You know, that's, you know, they'll always go to Shea and it's a goalkeeping error. And that's fair. But, you know, so they will always kind of have that mentality. But it was just so wild that it was kind of, yes, don't let stats get in the way of a good story, but sometimes you have to admit the stats are overwhelming.
If Dunphy shows us anything, from that you don't have to admit anything. Like, you never admit, never acknowledge that there might be any flaw.
And Kenny didn't back down, in fairness to him. He did not back down.
Yeah. I mean, you could argue, like, Arsenal have had an easy run in the Championship. They haven't played any of the big, like, you know, the teams that might score 8 goals against them. You know what I mean? Mm. They didn't play PSG, didn't play Bayern. So, like, is the jury still out, maybe, on their Champions League thing? You know, that they, who, like, did Atleti even try to score? It was kind of odd, because the game was nearly finished, and they still weren't all that concerned, it seemed, about scoring. So, they were maybe a little bit lucky, Arsenal, in that.
But it is interesting, too, that thing, as you said, Linda, about what Souness got when he came over here and brought back to England and to Sky, because it seems to me now Sky is essentially a lot, especially on the big matches, you know what you're going to get.
Mm.
Where RTE had this pearl richer than all their tribe, to quote Othello, and they threw it away. Like that sense of, you know what you're going to get on a big night. And I remember, again, like you said, like being at Ireland matches, I remember like Ireland-Slovakia, 0-0, Trapattoni, and you're at the game, and at halftime, you've suffered through this in the press box, in the ground, but you're actually going down to say, well, at least when we turn on the television at halftime, Giles Brady and Dunphy are going to provide some entertainment. And Sky have that now. You know that when it's a big game, it'll be Neville, it'll be Keane, it'll be these people, and you're going to get that analysis that is whatever it is, it is going to sort of, you know, get you through the 15 minutes that the match mightn't have provided. But that's gone now from the RTE punditry.
Yeah, I think there is definitely a safety element, you know, and I think as well there is that fear of, you know, kind of being afraid to say it, depending on where people are in their careers, are they still looking to be in management? Are they still looking to be in coaching? Are they still looking to be involved? Are you going to sit there and criticise the people that may, you know, you may be sitting in front of for an interview in a couple of months' time? I think there's an element in that. But that's what I think was so refreshing about it the other night, was that it was just, you know, stats be damned. I'm just, nobody cares about that. You can't, you know, because what he did say was, okay, Atletico didn't score, but they should have. Well, you know, the Arsenal defence stopped them scoring. Yeah. Whatever however much weight you want to give to what they were doing versus, was it, were they stopping them scoring or were they just not able to score? You know, but it was it was definitely entertaining and definitely, as I said, kept us talking.
You were at one of those pundits.
I just wanted to say Conor McKeown's main piece on his running the half marathon last week is absolutely worth a read as well. But yeah, I was at Roy Keane in Three Arena last night, and I thought it was awful. And do you know what I thought it was? Everything Keane would profess to hate. And I just, there was nothing new, absolutely nothing new, nothing you hadn't heard before. It was Roddy Doyle kind of hosting again. Very, you know, I'd love to hear a little bit from Roddy about, you know, what's it like getting that phone call? Will you do Keane's book? What's your first phone call with him like? Was there any point? You know, give us 5 minutes of that at the start. They walked out on the stage. They showed the clip on the big screen from Keane and Vieira in the tunnel. And he came out. They sat down and it was straight into, you were first spotted by a scout playing up in Fairview Park, just up the road from here, and off you went to Nottingham Forest. And it just went off. There was no big moment. They got Saipan out of the way kind of just before the interval. It felt like, unless, you know, we have to talk about it again, nothing new.
But how many people were there last night?
I think it holds 10,000.
And they're all paying what?
€80 a ticket.
So is this just not one of those situations where, like Stadium Rock, where people just, you know, they get so big that, you know, people will say, I saw U2 at the Dandelion Market, and then I had to go and see them at Croke Park, and the Dandelion Market was better. Like, you know, when we had Roy to ourselves, in like, and there's, you know, like Roy has become such a huge entertainment figure now. That what can we expect except that he just delivers the hits?
I think if you're going to charge €80 per person, I think you should be delivering more than the hits. I think there should be nuggets that haven't been seen or heard before, haven't been written in books, you know, before, haven't been spoken about on podcasts. It felt so flat, and I kind of thought, second half, maybe we'll pick up a bit here. The biggest cheer of the night was when he put Paul McGrath into his best 11 that he's ever played with. They also did, so he did his best 11 he's ever played with, and then they did a second, the best 11 from the current Premier League, which had obviously so many City players and Liverpool players. They were like, this is not going down well with this crowd. You know, what are you expecting to achieve with, you know, 10,000 people, probably a conservative estimate, 8,000 of the Man United fans, and you're sitting talking about how great Haaland is, you know, with a couple of little digs to his dad, that, you know, kind of, oh, that's going to get us through this. It was so flat. And I, you know, and look, I'm a journalist. I go in wanting to know new things. Tell me something new. Tell me something. And my, you know, when I'm editing a piece and sitting there going, right, what's my headline? I can't even tell you what my headline was from last night. There wasn't one.
But did the crowd enjoy it?
There was two people I know who were there kind of texted me afterwards, that was great. And I kind of said, God, I don't know what you felt was great about it. But obviously there was a couple of people as we were walking out, you know, I was kind of talking to my partner on the way out and a few people kind of overheard us and were saying to us it was really flat. Like, if that's, you know, if you want to just go and hear Roy Keane talking about Roy Keane for 2 hours, you got that. But you didn't hear.
Sounded like you needed Andoni Iriola.
Would you pay 80 euro to see Iriola at Three Arena?
Oh, God, yes. just talking. You wouldn't have to talk to Roddy Doyle. You just
talk about soul.
Yeah, he's a very interesting man. I saw.
On Keane, Declan, it is interesting because, like what Linda says there, like, you know, we've almost had to make peace with this idea of Keane doing things that we felt, you know, are the antithesis of the Roy Keane ideology, if you like, was. Yeah. And Dave Hannigan's book recently on Keane is very good on that and how, you know, he has, like, you know, the Irish hold we thought we had on him, he's kind of thrown that all off. Like, he has become... I think in the book, Dave quotes Eamon Sweeney, who referred to him as the Terry Wogan of Irish sport now. And that shouldn't be seen as a criticism. Like, he has become an entertainer. And in Ireland, I always feel with Roy, we wanted him to be a very certain type of... We held quite dearly to the kind of image of him as the kind of ascetic, austere leader that was going to take us places. And now that he's just doing it all for fun, we still, even though there's so many of us there, there's a number of us who still feel kind of this isn't the Roy we actually want.
Yeah, I mean, in England, he has a very distinctive kind of presence because he complains about a lot of things, you know, and that's that in Sky terms, that sort of makes him a kind of a unique kind of character because they're naturally disinclined to be moaning and complaining about anything because life is great, you know? So, and football's great. So like, in that sense, he has a kind of very distinct, that he doesn't really, it doesn't really work here where, like, everybody is complaining all the time, you know? So he lacks that kind of uniqueness. I suppose what's kind of disappointing is that with people like him, who are kind of difficult or very unusual, you expect them to be more kind of selective, I suppose. I mean, like, Bob Dylan doesn't even show up with his own kind of performances sort of thing. You know what I mean? He kind of, you expect some kind of idiosyncrasy or weirdness to still be hanging around them. And doing these, like, awful podcast things or whatever I don't even understand what that stuff is about, to be honest with you. There's someone doing a radio program on a sort of for 10,000 people. I actually don't. I would never go to anything like that. I would go to REO Speedwagon playing in a sort of a stadium rock venue rather than that. There you go. But you know, I find it very hard to imagine how something like that would be good. Even if Roy was very interesting, you know, it's just not a format that I like. But I think that's it. It's like he just seems to do anything now. You know what I mean? He's doing ads for Sky, all that kind of stuff, and it just makes him a bit less interesting, I suppose.
The aura is gone, as you said. Yeah, the mystique is gone. But everyone's got to make a living.
The footballers, of course, as well. There is a rule in football that all money is welcome in all situations, in all circumstances, and there are no circumstances in which is not welcome. That there is that.
There was a lot of last night was, especially when it was the players he'd played with 11, when he was going through that, there was a lot of this, you know, oh, he was a great man to go out for a pint with as well. Tell me more. And that's what there was a serious lack of. And, you know, obviously you don't want to be hanging anybody out to dry, but you can tell a couple of stories. You know, I've seen other players tell them about Roy, so, you know, you're perfectly entitled. I saw Lee Sharp in Hotel Football a couple of years ago, and my nephew was with me. He's 14 now, so he's probably 12 at the time. Not really known who Lee Sharp was, had looked him up on YouTube, saw a few things. And he loved it. And it was, you know, and I loved it. And there was new stuff in there. There was stuff you hadn't heard before. And, you know, it was just, it was really well done. Again, as you're saying, it was a much smaller venue. So is that what it was? It was the lack of intimacy was what, that if you'd heard Roy telling these stories in, you know, a smaller room, would it have been better? I expected more.
Yeah, see, that's interesting what you say there, that, like, you know, he didn't follow through on certain things. Mm. There is just an odd thing about that footballers, that to us, they lead these incredibly interesting lives. And yet to them, there are things that are just not interesting. Genuinely, they don't understand why on earth would anybody be interested in that, whereas we are hugely interested in it, you know? Mm. I mean, on the broader point, there is that argument that only in the most extreme circumstances should ex-professional footballers actually be pundits, because from an early age, it's absolutely drilled into them that to say nothing about anything, to keep everything to themselves, that the enemy is outside, the enemy is the media and normal people, right? Mm-hmm. And you keep everything to yourself and within this group. So they're so kind of institutionalized in that sense that even someone as unusual as Keane, there's that inclination to sort of, I'm not going to say that because who the hell would be interested in that? And whereas in fact, these are hugely interesting things, and you just never really, you know, like a point I've made here before, like Gary Neville is regarded as one of the better pundits, interesting and all this kind of stuff. I still don't get a sense of what it was like to be, what Fergie was really like. You know, it's still, they're still at the stage of the hairdryer and all that stuff, right? Like, you'd love to, I mean, the man who was able to describe West Ham beating them as almost obscene, right? There are things you need to know about him that you're just not getting, even from the most kind of interesting people who were there.
Were there any references to Fergie last night?
Yeah, quite a few. Now, again, didn't push very far. You know, he did talk about the last meeting where, you know, when Fergie said to him, I think we're done here. And, you know, Roy kind of, he said, he told his solicitor before he went in, they're going to push me out today. And he said, no chance. And they went in and Fergie said, I think we're done here. And his reaction was, okay. He said, you know, it wasn't to stay and fight. It wasn't to say, is there, you know, anything. It was like, okay, but again, that's nothing that hasn't been said before. He didn't talk about, when he was talking about Saipan, he kind of didn't talk about Fergie's involvement there, which again, you know, is a very interesting element of it. There was no mention of it there. But yeah, no, there were quite a few references, you know, and quite a few references to Clough. You can tell, you know, how highly he rated Clough.
Well, it's funny, I always think with Keane now, like his exit from Manchester United has totally framed how he describes the two great managers he worked for. So Clough is now elevated into a special position in the pantheon as far as Roy is concerned, whereas Ferguson, could you describe it as a lack of generosity when he talks about Ferguson? Because, you know, there's the reality of their alliance when it was working was extraordinary, and Keane, for whatever reason, for maybe obvious reasons, doesn't seem inclined to kind of frame it like that anymore. And if that's what he was doing last night, that again is kind of, I think there's a much more interesting piece to go to with Roy about Ferguson that actually acknowledges, look, for a long time you had something extraordinary. And now it's like, well, you know, what else are you going to do? Like, that's natural. Like, I was a postman delivering the mail or whatever his line is. Like, but he won't go there.
There's always this perception that he was Ferguson on the pitch. Yeah. You know, that they had this a real sort of unity of purpose, and that would be interesting to talk about, I guess.
You know? Yeah, and he was 3 years under Clough. He was 13 under Fergie, and yet it's Clough is, you know, and he talked about last night when Clough punched him one time after you know, after a match, but as you say, Ferguson is everything Keane would want in a manager, everything.
Yeah,
and yet he still has this where he doesn't. He holds back, in his praise of him, and I think it is because of how it ended.
And Clough at the time, Keane was a player under him, was sort of finished as a man. Or he was on the his decline was pretty obvious at that point. So he wasn't working under Clough at his peak by any means.
No. But also, you know, and it was mentioned last night how you know, blessed he was when you look at things now to have, you know, in his club career, apart from Celtic, to have only played under two managers in 16 years is incredible.
I always think with Keane as well, that fact that he was punched by Clough also demonstrates how determined he was to make it. And again, Dave Hannigan's book details this very well, like that sense of a player mm-hmm. who wasn't going to let anything get in his. He'd got this, this was his last ticket out. He'd got a trip, he'd got a gig, you know, chance at Nottingham Forest. If the manager was going to punch him, he didn't care. Yeah. Like, he wasn't going to let that stand in the way. I want mm-hmm. to be mm-hmm. a footballer. And if, you know, if I've got to take the occasional smack in the mouth from mm-hmm. from my manager, so be it. Like, I'm not going to storm off home over this, yeah. you know?
Yeah, there was lesser things made him storm off.
Well, that's not we all good. Well, that brings us to the World Cup.
Yeah.
Miguel Delaney's piece in the Sunday Independent, Welcome to the Great World Cup of Rip-Offs. Mm. And this is, piece which really details how egregious this World Cup is going to be in terms of... of everything, really. Declan, are you looking forward to this World Cup?
Oh, always looking forward to World Cup. Yeah. Then I suddenly remembered, oh my God, it's in America. Trump's America. The big picture on the piece, it's one I hadn't seen before, oddly enough, where Infantino is presenting this big, match ticket for the World Cup final to Trump. And if you look at the small print, it says, President Donald J. Trump, row one, seat one. And then ticket number 45/47, right? It is a remarkable thing. Like, this philosophy driving the World Cup, apparently, the American one, is to fully optimize revenue using all tools available, which I suppose would be the guiding principle of so many things. The mess they've made of the thing is quite astonishing. Like, even just it's noted in the piece that you have the same countries would be playing, like I say, in Boston and Dallas. That even within, if you go to the World Cup, you have these ridiculous distances you have to travel just to see the team in the group stages, right? That they almost forgot how big the place was, and that human beings have to make decisions sometimes about how much money they have to do something, right? It's almost as if, like, people like Infantino now live purely in a world of billionaires, and they've actually no connection anymore with an ordinary person who might want to go to the World Cup and might not have endless amounts of money. Quite apart from the basic sort of revulsion a lot of people have about going to America at all at the moment, and a basic kind of fear that they're going to go into a completely hostile environment, that America is simply the opposite of what it used to be. Mm-hmm. It's more like some sort of weird, lawless kind of country in the old Soviet bloc or something, where you have to bribe everyone to do something, or just a place where rules don't apply and you don't know what's going to happen. So it'll be so interesting to see, will there be anyone at the game? When you're looking at the matches, when you are indeed looking at three matches a day, as undoubtedly all of us will be, will they be just empty, or will they then just bus a lot of people into them for nothing? Like you famously have in just lawless countries, where totally corrupt countries, where they just have to have some kind of something for television.
Make it look good.
Well, this is where dynamic pricing should come into its own. If suddenly tickets should be available for $10.
Yeah. I do, like you asked, Jack, and are you looking forward to it? And I feel, yes, I'm looking forward to it, because it's not going to cost me. As much as I wish we were there, I don't know if I'd be looking forward to it so much if I was going to it, because there's a great line just in the middle of this piece, and it's from Peter Moore, who's the founding owner of US club Santa Barbara Sky. And he says, the simple question is who this World Cup is supposed to be for. And that's, that's the bottom line of it. Because the World Cup shouldn't be for presidents and billionaires, it should be for fans and ordinary people. There's, Declan's talking about the game's been so far apart, but even when you get to the city it's in, part here that says there's the headline issue of local transport. Getting to Foxborough's Gillette Stadium from Boston will cost $80 on a train or $95 on a bus. And again, for a lot of people who are going, they're probably going to look go down the road of hiring a car. Mm. You know, if it, anything, you know, if you go by Taylor Swift's, I think it was a New York concert, parking was $125, you know, for just to park your car 20 minutes walk from the stadium. Like, it's ludicrous stuff. And trying to, you know, just feed yourself. I think most people are going to be living on fast food because, you know, it's maybe just over a year since I was in the States, but it's expensive to just do very, very ordinary things.
Peter Moore actually estimates that it will cost between $10,000 and $35,000 to follow your team right through. Mm. Dion, you had a good experience in Germany. In the wasn't it like the World Cup in Germany?
That was
transport.
That was a journalistic perk, I think. That all trains were free.
Yeah,
I think trains were free for fans as well. Actually,
yeah, there was something like
I
that.
I think Qatar did. Yeah, yeah. I think their transport to the stadium was
free. But again, that was now one of the things with America is it's a very expensive place to go to anyway, it's one of those things. But I think it's you know, they've got obviously, as you say, Declan Infantino. Now this is the world he wants to live in, but it is extraordinary, as Miguel details that. On Thursday, when the ticket prices were discussed in front of Donald Trump, winner of the, you know, inaugural FIFA Peace Prize, he's obviously forgotten about that. He said, I wouldn't pay it either when talking about the ticket prices. So for Infantino, that's a bit of a slap in the face, given, you know, not that he'll continue to be as obsequious around Trump as always. But when Trump is saying that these prices are kind of out of whack, it's bad news.
And, you know, I think there was a lot made of the $60 tickets, you know, but it turns out that a lot, you know, the $60 tickets that haven't been taken up are gone back in, and the resale value is far, far higher, like $2,500 for what was a $60 ticket. And that same thing, like, what, you know, I mean, we experienced it with, you know, Oasis last year was probably one of the biggest things where you could be sitting in a seat that you've paid $60 for, and the person next to you may pay $2,500. It's like, it's madness. And dynamic pricing is something I absolutely, it's one of my biggest bugbears in life. Something costs something. That's what it costs. Mm. End of story. And, you know, whereas now it's become, well, it costs what people are willing to pay for it. Mm. But that's not determined ahead of time. That's determined by a computer when everybody's sitting on there trying to get it, you know. So the whole thing, I think any teams that are mainly in Mexico or Canada are probably, Mexico in particular, I think, are on the lucky end of things.
I was going to ask the question then, is there dynamic pricing in the GEA? I don't know, tell me, Linda, is there,
let's talk about a few pieces, subscriptions are certainly...
There's also this very interesting geopolitical aspects to the World Cup, which is, you know, watching some of the refereeing decisions will be quite interesting, because there's absolutely no doubt what the host nation wants Argentina to win, right? Trump wants Argentina to win because Milei, he's an ally of his. He does not want Brazil to win because Brazil have put his mate in jail, Bolsonaro, right? So if anyone who thinks those considerations will be entirely forgotten by all concerned, probably will be surprised.
You see, in an earlier era, that would have just been dismissed as conspiratorial madness from you.
I know, yeah.
But, you know,
now look at me.
But actually, now look at you. Yeah. You know, conspiracist and correct. The Ronaldo situation, the Ronaldo story with the sending off is actually a great example of that.
Yeah.
When you know, sent off against Ireland, and a suspension which should have just been a standard. Mm-hmm. We know how this works, and football has never allowed those things to get, you know, the wriggle room in these situations. And there he is getting it reduced. So he's
never allowed before.
Yeah.
May we suddenly see them being allowed a little
things,
bit.
Things that actually now make the, you know, and I'll be just, you know, revealing my own prejudices here, make football look a little bit more like the GAA.
Yeah.
Well, like, I mean, this is the same Trump that said last year, you know, we might even see Putin here. That'd be great, you know? Like,
oh, that'd be great. It'd be great to have him here, wouldn't it? Yeah, it'd be great.
You know?
Yeah.
Anyway, let's move on to, you know, dynamic pricing in the GAA. Well, not dynamic pricing, but the GAA Plus is a kind of perennial now this time of the year. Mm-hmm. And the the draw for the, you know, Kerry and Donegal draw, and that match, I think is now, it has now been decided that's on GA Plus, I think. That's led to, you know, it's made Liveline, and Mark Gallagher and Shane McGrath, two pieces in the mail on this, and they're both very good on it. But again, it's just one of those questions about what is the GAA for, I think, is the thing that we come back to endlessly.
Now, I think, and Shane makes a point in his, you know, the champions of GAA Plus always argue that its price is highly competitive. €95 for seasons past, that includes live coverage of 40 matches. You know, if we're all sitting down, writing down what our subscriptions cost, how much we actually pay per game, that is fairly reasonable, I think. You know, Mark Gallagher makes the point that the GAA, not only is it, you know, it, have they got the games, but they're doing a good job of it as well.
Right.
You know, so again, you can't really argue with that. But, you know, and again, and if something is on Liveline, it almost always is, won't someone think of the children? And, you know, and that's, is, I don't know how many children out there are sitting watching, you know, every GAA game that's on the TV. A lot of them, if they're anything like any of the teenagers and kids I hang around, are probably half on their phones, half paying attention, you know, going up to their room to sulk about something. So, you know, this is more about the core fans. I'm certainly a person, I don't mind paying for something if I feel I'm getting value for money. I think GAA Plus offers that, but, you know, there's always going to be the, this is something we should have for free. But I, you know, there's the pull quote in this one is the association needs to maximise its commercial potential, and that, you know, that is true. That, you know, this is not a charity. This is not, you know.
But it's an interesting point, because Shane McGrath makes it in his piece as well. This is about business, and this is where it starts to get tricky for the GAA. Its advocates are fluent in the language of cultural importance, community cohesion, and the volunteering spirit. And there is a century and a half of compelling proof attesting to the association's importance. And we all know about that. And now, again, you know, the GAA stressed that they're not the only organisation in the country where there is huge amounts of volunteering taking place. Most sports, every sport in this country functions essentially through volunteering, whether or not people at the very top of the pyramid are being paid. And there are a number of people at the top of the GAA pyramid who are being paid. You know, not players necessarily, but again, it's a model that isn't that much different. But when the GAA stress that, it's very hard for them then to turn around and say, not only are we a business, but we're a business with on both sides of this fence. We're broadcasters, and we're actually the people deciding who gets the contracts for broadcasting.
Yeah, but I think the quality of a product is always going to be directly related to the kind of money it generates. And I think that is something that has to be accepted. You know, is if without paying for something, you're going to get an inferior product. So is it the amount you have to pay? Again, coming back to what it costs, I don't think it's an extortionate amount of money. Or is it the principle of paying? Because if it's that, then, you know, you have to accept that if you want the GA, you know, do you want the GA to stay where it is, or do you want it to get better? Do you want, you know, the stadiums to get better? Do you want the grassroots to get better? Do you want your local GAA club to have, you know, better facilities? If you want all of that, then at some point you have to pay for that in some way. And I think GAA Plus is a part of that.
But again, like, this is the point that, again, I think Mark quotes it, you know, we were told ad nauseum, 83% of the revenue goes back to its members. That includes almost $20 million on grants for county teams, $50 million on coaching and games development, and $8 million on an injury fund for more than 6,000 players. But, and this is separate money, I know that the county boards who are maybe playing, you know, are managers at club level getting paid in the GAA. There's all these things that, again, expose, when you start digging into, you're like, what? How amateur is this? You know, like, we, and if you have this shield of volunteerism and amateurism, you can actually acquire an awful lot of professional, you know, the same professional standards and the same professional impulses as sports that don't have that shield,
mm-hmm.
while saying, "Oh, we're doing this, we're putting it all back." So it seems like a tension to me. And the one thing you said there, Linda, which I'm going to ask you about, is, you know, you talk about the kids, and people talk about the kids on Liveline. To me, and this is as somebody who's written a book about poor old fellas, this seems to be actually a situation where it's the other end of the demographic that suffers. Because I don't know where...
No, the poor old fellas always suffer, no matter what demographic.
But where is, like, GA Plus, you have to watch it on your laptop or on the phone, all that kind of stuff. It's not on, and I think Mark makes this point that they need to get it onto Sky or Virgin or all those television platforms to make it easier. Mm-hmm. But it is something that is going to be a struggle still for other people to deal with, to get to actually access.
Yeah, look, I mean, the GA in all these situations will say, look, we live in the modern world now, and, you know, if you want to watch your Champions League, you have to have subscriptions and all this kind of stuff. I know that's the modern world, but I don't like the modern world, right? That is my problem with this, right? That I still am, you know, I'm kind of programmed by kind of the great benefits of public service broadcasting over 50 years, right? That I'll be there on a Tuesday night fully expecting that my entitlement as a human being is to watch the semi-final of the Champions League, and it's not on a proper television station. It's on sort of, you know, something that, you know, I may or may not have on my package. I'll have to check, you know what I mean? So that whole kind of culture, it's like the trickle-up theory, right? That we're watching a vast redistribution of wealth from the bottom to the top, so that we got like this thing of public squalor and private opulence. I can no longer see a semi-final of the European Cup on the television because Kylian Mbappe needs 5 million quid a day, basically, right? And it's wrong, and it's destroying sport at a certain level, because the whole culture and the whole status of a sport is so crucially based on young people having wide access to it for free, basically, right? And almost seeing it accidentally or whatever, right? And once you take that away, right, I don't know, well, clearly it diminishes it, right? Clearly it keeps the absolute elite people happy. It makes sure you have sort of some sort of functioning elite. But even still, the European Cup is getting worse all the time. The Champions League is getting worse all the time. It's like you got about three meaningful matches every year now, you know.
But they're, you know, what matches they are.
Sure. But I would prefer four or five.
The point about this, though, surely, is that, like, you know, no, UEFA, FIFA, as we know, they aren't going around claiming to be important cultural institutions, but, you know, existing for the betterment. Okay, Infantino is, but everyone laughs at him.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But
in fairness, I think of almost all sports administrators do that. You know.
But the GAA asserts itself as something significant in Irish life and something important, way beyond its commercial.
Yeah, in fairness to it, I always should mention this, that they don't take gambling sponsorship. Mm-hmm. That is very, very good and very unusual, and it should always be mentioned as a good thing, I think, you know.
But they did things, you know, even the split season, and I, you know, again, as an armchair GA watcher, it's something I'm against, because it's a
well used armchair, I would say.
Well, no, a very well used armchair. But again, it's just the rhythm of this of the summer has been destroyed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, they did that for reasons. No entirely commercially driven organization would have said, we're going to run these tournaments off in the shortest amount of time possible, so that our players who play for clubs, which there isn't going to be a huge amount of viewers for, can actually get a fair crack at things. They would have said, how can we actually make this season run for 12 months a year? So in some ways, there's contradictions there. But GA Plus seems to be something where it's very hard to square with that claims, about those claims.
There's a worry it's a slippery slope as well, you know, and Sky Sports started it with football, so where it was one, you needed to subscribe to one thing a season, and now I think we have four, maybe five now, to see everything. So there is a worry of that, and yes, I think it is an identity thing for the GAA, is, as you say, but do you have to be one thing or the other? Can, you know, I think the GAA in recent years has fallen in somewhere in the middle. And so, I, you know, it's, if you want better facilities, if you want, you know, a better game, things have to give. You can't, you know, you can't stay at a fully amateur status forever, I don't think.
There is another story, GAA story, in the Sunday Independent today, John Green and Nadine Doherty. Very detailed story. Frustration, anger, and a flawed process. This is a story about a game last year between Kilkerran, Clonburn, and Westport. And there was some aftermath of John Green and Nadine Doherty detail it when during last Sunday's Connacht Senior Football Championship final in Carrick on Shannon. But the game in November was the first time, or that game was the first time since players from Kilkerran, Clonburn, and Westport had faced each other since they met in the Connacht Club semi-final last November. During that game, there was an alleged incident of racial abuse towards a Westport player, and there's a lot of anger in Mayo LGFA circles over how the subsequent complaint was handled by the authorities. The game was played on November 2nd in Westport, and during it, it is alleged that a racial slur was directed at a Westport player. In the days immediately after the game, two players who witnessed the incident spoke about it and raised it with their teammate who was the target. Once awareness grew in the club over what had allegedly happened, attempts were made to have the matter addressed. That proved difficult because the incident had not been reported immediately. It took the club some time to navigate its way through procedure. Then in late February, the Westport player, along with her witnesses, attended a Connacht LGFA complaints, objections, disciplinary and appeals hearing. Neither the club nor the player were informed of the outcome of this hearing, although anecdotally they heard a suspension of 6 months and a fine had been handed down to the Kilkerran Clonburn player. The Westport player and witnesses were then summoned to a hearing before the Central Appeals Committee on February 24th, and again the club says it was not informed of the outcome of that appeal, although again anecdotally they heard the initial suspension and fine had been reduced. On Friday night, Kilkerran, Clonburn and Galway forward Eva Noon confirmed she was the player against whom the allegation was made. This allegation is entirely untrue and without foundation, and I have consistently denied it, said Noon in an Instagram post. Noon revealed that she had been suspended by the CAC for 16 weeks and fined €200. She said that she was fined and suspended for a breach of Rule 2.3d, engaging in insulting behaviour to other competitors, match officials or any officials. She did not say what the initial punishment had been. Noon then took her case to the Disputes Resolution Authority, where the findings against her were quashed. She said the DRA determined that the disciplinary process was fundamentally flawed. That case was heard in March. The Westport Club did not receive notice of the DRA hearing, the first anyone in Mayo LGFA circles officially knew of the findings by the three disciplinary bodies in February and March, was via Noon's social media post on Friday night. No formal communication, written determination or explanation to DRA has been made public or forwarded to the Westport or the player concerned, while there is no definitive explanation available to indicate the basis for any of the decisions made at any point in the process. In a statement yesterday, the Westport Club said, throughout this process, our members cooperated fully at every stage, including attending multiple hearings and appeals, including one appeal hearing for which our members received just one day's notice. At all times, our primary concern has been the well-being, dignity and support of our club member. However, we wish to make clear that neither the club nor the player directly received any notice whatsoever of the subsequent hearing before the DRA. Neither was invited to participate in any capacity, attend the hearing, provide submissions or even informed that the appeal was taking place. So, Linda, this is a story which, you know, and we will note, and we've already noted it there, that this ultimately the findings against the player involved were quashed, and you know the player has made her own statement this on Friday night, saying, you know, this allegation is entirely untrue and without any foundation. But I think this is a story as much about the process as anything else.
Absolutely, it was handled so badly. Like the word anecdotally, it just screams at me from that page that, you know, They weren't informed of the outcome, although anecdotally they heard about the suspension and the fine. Mm. Like, that's ludicrous, absolutely ludicrous. They should have been involved at every single step of this process, and they absolutely weren't. And, you know, even if at the very least you should be informed in the aftermath of what has happened at these hearings and, you know, these decisions, why these decisions were made. Minutes are taken at these meetings for very good reason, you know, why these minutes haven't been shared and, you know, some kind of explanation given to the club and the player as to why this happened the way it happened.
There's a line further on in the piece where the Sunday Independent, where they say, on Thursday we asked the LGFA a series of questions around the incident and the disciplinary process that followed. We also asked what its policies around racial abuse in its games were. The LGFA declined to comment. It is deeply frustrating that the LGFA's response to what is the LGFA's policy around racial abuse is to decline to comment.
Yeah, we don't discuss individual cases. our old friend.
But to not actually be able to say this is how we deal with these situations seems to be extraordinary.
Yeah, really, and like whatever about telling you, if they can't even tell you what the process is. You know, and it doesn't have to relate to this particular incident. Just tell us what the process is, and to not even be able to tell you.
I mean, this is like a newspaper ringing them up, so at least they could say, "We'll get back to you on that" or something.
but again, you would expect.
We can't comment on individual cases, but this is what
this
normally happens.
This is how we handle the. Yeah. This is our process for dealing with this, and this seems to be a situation that hasn't. That, you know, better structures definitely need to be in place for.
I did note that it did that the Gaelic Players Association has reached out directly to the player, you know, which I think is, and comes back again to our point about, you know, there are things within the GAA that need money and need to be funded. Mm. And, you know, I certainly think that's one of those things.
Live Golf.
Mm. Yeah.
The great dream is over.
there's a
couple of pieces in the Sunday Times, Rick Broadbent and then David Walsh on caddies, who we'll get to that in a minute, although I wasn't aware that caddies were having such a great time.
Having a moment, yeah.
But Rick Broadbent's piece details, the rise of Live Golf and, you know, how the right-hand man of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, Yasir al-Rumayyan, is an avowed golf fanatic. Mm. And there are a number of putting mats in his high-rise office.
Well, he'd need them for the tricky downhillers.
Right. Putting mat wouldn't do it.
No. I think that's when you know sort of you're dealing with an elite member of society. That, you know, that there, most of us now would probably have just the flat mat. But right. I mean, what good is that? I mean, you know, you need sort of... like the tricky downhillers, the kind of 5-footers, the... You know, you have long putts as well, short putts.
I'm sure he's got the office that could accommodate the long putts.
Yeah, well, that's it, yeah. He's got, in fact, his office is in the shape of the 18th green at Augusta.
That's one of the things I was about to go, is it? Like, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, it wouldn't. Yeah.
But Linda, there's amazing, like there is, like the detail of the rise and fall of Liv is kind of incredible.
It is, you know, and some of it you kind of forget, and you know, to just kind of have it going back through, you know, that they're talking about Kevin Na, who'd never come close to winning a major, signed for $25 million. Mm. You know, it's mad stuff. You know, the 2022 Masters, arguably the most coveted prize in golf, the winner Scottie Scheffler took home $2.7 million. 2 months later, at Liv's first event just off the M1 in Hertfordshire, Charles Schwartzel won $4.75 million. Like, the numbers are absolutely incredible. But, you know, one thing that kind of stuck out to me was that, you know, not even the Saudis have a bottomless pit. And it seems to be much of this, you know, kind of sidelining of it now is to do with them getting the World Cup, and money now needs to be diverted. And, you know, a lot of these decisions were made before the current unrest in the Middle East. So you can only expect that their, you know, their coffers will be hit even further over the next while. But, you know, it kind of said the Saudi government undertook a review of what it was spending money on and what the returns were. Mohammed bin Salman's view now is that national transformation is all about hitting targets. So even the Saudis Well, have targets.
One line here jumps out as well. Aramian said that anyone shooting a round of 54 could have another $54 million.
Was the other funny thing was that, you know, it was called LIV because it's the Roman numerals for 54, and then it stopped being 54 holes. So, you know, the whole.
But is there a point in that, Declan, as well? Like, the money is crazy. Like, they're talking about Pat Perez singing We Are the Champions after winning $900,000. Yeah. Pat Perez for finishing 29th. But ultimately, one of those things that is important about sport is there has to be some sort of thread between, like, through its history.
Yeah.
So when you start coming along and saying we're going to have 54 holes and all the other kind of quirks and little, and cricket has done this as well with the 100 and these things that nobody understands and nobody really wants to watch. They want something that is connected to the history of the game.
That's right. That's what the point I was kind of making about the whole Champions League and the way television, plays a part and like, you know, sort of free-to-air television is really important for a sport like the World Cup, all that kind of stuff, right? Similarly, there is that kind of, nebulous value on the history and the traditions of any sport. And, golf is no different. I mean, you have these really old tournaments that are on in America. The PGA are a horrible organization, right? One of the weird aspects of this is that LIV initially, like PGA appear to be the progressive, more liberal-minded rather than these like crazy people, with their anti-human rights sort of agenda. But you can't just sort of say we're going to set up this game again, sort of opposed to the old one, and there is a value to the fact that the Greater Greensboro Open or something has been there since whenever, there is a history and tradition there that does seem to have a great value now. All that said, the decline of LIV, this is a real good news story. Like, I mean, it's we should be celebrating this. Like, initially, I think the Saudis, the broad idea was that with the oil running out, they were buying into, if you like, kind of the West, into the cultural riches of the West, and they were appropriating all these kind of football, golf, etc., right? And the sports washing, all that kind of stuff. But one of the downsides of all the sports washing was that one of the main things it did was to draw attention to sports washing, so that every article written about Manchester City or written about this stuff mentioned sports washing, a journalist being chopped up in suitcases and stuff, right? So, in a weird way, there was a Streisand effect to it, right? But the individual tragedies involved in this are those of John Rahm and Cameron Smith, who, for reasons that I will never understand, decided to take
I'll give you a reason.
$300 million
and $100 million.
Well, I can't understand that. Incomprehensible.
However, it is incomprehensible in the context of the fact that they already had so many millions and were absolutely sure to make many tens more millions, right? See, one of the arguments in favour of great wealth is that it gives you the freedom to not do things, right? These lads apparently didn't have that freedom, because Cameron Smith had just won the Open. John Rahm had won two majors, was going to be cruising towards for the next 10 years. He doesn't look like winning any majors, never hasn't done while he's been with LIV. Cameron Smith initially said that LIV will give him the freedom to go to mates' weddings, right? Well, I hope that worked out okay. I mean, that was a fair trade, wasn't it? You know, he missed out, didn't win the Masters, didn't win, you know. So I don't understand it. I know the difference between 300 million and like 100 million, but still, for someone like...
But it's intergenerational wealth. Mm-hmm.
There is that. That became the buzz for a while. Generational wealth, yeah. which was even wealth to the power of wealth, But if you're John Rahm, I think Nick Faldo pointed out that one of the problems is that the courses they play, they're more like sort of, your local golf society down in the pub would kind of play right. them. Like, they're not championship courses. So they're not actually, you know, when they get to a major, they don't quite have the edge that they should have. But David Walsh points out, like, the things we're finding out now about that, in fact, the Saudis were great egalitarian and they were a source for good in the world.
Can we, the opening of David Walsh's piece is worth reading. I rang an old acquaintance late on Thursday night, though it was early evening for him. "Where are you right now?" I asked. "I'm sipping a beer on the terrace of the Players and Caddies Lounge at Trump National Golf Club in Virginia." We're not talking Virginia County Cavan. "A nice evening? Great. Had lobster and a tomahawk steak for dinner. The lobster was a bit salty, but still nice. And of course, you didn't have to pay." Oh no, absolutely not. Yeah, and that is a conversation with a caddy.
Yeah, the Saudis, God bless them, the caddies are treated wonderfully.
Yeah.
The PGA Tour are, you know, the sort of dark-hearted organization they are, still treats them appallingly. Mm-hmm. Apparently, like, they're sort of kept almost, have to, you know.
Well, there's a quote from the caddy Billy Foster in this. So, you know, said, "As a caddy on the PGA Tour, if your player misses the cut, you lose money because you pay your own expenses. You've worked all week, missed the cut, so you get naught. Then flip it to the Live Tour, where your flights are paid for, your hotels are paid for, you eat with the players, and you're not treated like a rat tied up outside the clubhouse, which I've had for most of my career."
It says here, John Rahm's, you know, contrast to what I've been saying, John Rahm's caddy has put his 100-acre North Carolina estate on sale for $10.5
million.
He could understand it, I suppose. Yeah. He could understand why it happened, but not
Linda, me. You think it's...
Yeah, no, I have to say, I'm all for what Liv has done for the caddies. They seem incredibly happy about it. There's another caddy is quoted saying that, you know, that these horrible stink bins for toilets and no running water, that's how it used to be. And, you know, it's got better on the PGA, I believe, but still not incredible. Compared to what Lee is saying, like, you know, that the caddies are getting on the plane now and turning left, which was never, you know, they used to be hitchhiking, you know, and I think Colin Byrne speaks about that, trying, you know, hitchhiked, travelled on inexpensive overnight buses and became expert at finding one-star pensions. His parents wondered why he'd ever gone to Trinity College and got a good degree. But I think they understand it now because he's part-time and earning more money than he ever has.
So some people are going to suffer with the exit of Live from golf.
Won't someone think of the caddies?
Well, yeah, exactly.
They'll be on Liveline this week.
Yeah.
Folks, it's been a really great chat today. Thanks for coming in. It's been really wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks, Dion.
The Sunday Paper Review on Off the Ball.